You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. Good Wednesday morning, hump day, on April Fool's Day. Are we doing April Fool's today? I hope not. Or maybe we should, right? Life goes on. But I can imagine the cruel things that people would do. So just want to remind everybody, be careful today. Okay? Don't be that person who responds to something. Expect the unexpected. Okay, April Fool's Day. So, good morning to you. I want to give you a little bit of coronavirus quarantine advice. I found a TV show, and I don't watch this kind of stuff. But I found something that that Colleen and I are watching. And I was just perusing, because so in the evening, we try to do something together. And so we have moderately different tastes in what we watch. So I'm perusing Amazon Prime and I see this program called The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Now, I don't know if you've seen it. So, and I saw that it had won Emmys. So I thought, well, Colleen, let's watch this. And I don't know what kind of humor you like. But if you like intellectual humor, it's a story that's set in the late 50s in New York City. And Mrs. Maisel, right? I think she's known as Midge her character. She's lives on the Upper West Side. She's Jewish, yada, yada, yada. And, she's got the townhouse, two kids, boy and a girl. Parents live in the same building, and her husband leaves her, right? And her world falls apart. And then she winds up doing stand-up comedy. But she doesn't tell anybody. And she meets Lenny Bruce. She actually bails him out of jail, and then he bails her out of jail. And, so it's but it's really funny. I think it is anyway. And so I would offer that to you. If you like intellectual humor, and I mean, I think it's really funny. So, and I'm funny, so I kind of know funny. But it, yeah. So anyway, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Yeah, we're into the second season in about 3 or 4 days. So anyway, 3 days actually, because Colleen's only been here 3 days. So I would recommend that to you. I want to talk about charts. Okay, I don't know if you watched the president's daily briefing, but yesterday it went on forever. But it was good. And let me tell you why I thought it was good. You know, so much of what has happened, is this. People trying to make predictions, and the data just isn't good. Right? So the predictions that you see, you know, take your pick. How would you like to characterize them? You know, what would you like to say about them in terms of their predictive quality? The answer is they can't be very accurate because the data just isn't ample enough yet, right? But I would make the case to you sitting there that I believe there's a case for optimism. Yeah, how about that? I believe there's a case for optimism. And I mentioned this, but I want to talk about it a little bit more. If you look at the cumulative cases per 100,000 in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Washington and California, you see drastically different curves. Okay? You essentially see New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tracking the same path. Their curves follow the same arcs. And then you see Washington and California whose curves aren't following the same arcs. Okay, now, what I want to submit to you as a former economist who modeled and looked at graphs and data and things like that, I believe the case for optimism centers around the way different cities do mass transportation. And I believe, and that's why I think Governor Cuomo needs to tone his shit down. Okay? New York City, New Jersey, and Connecticut are not the graph for the rest of the nation. You want to know why? Because we don't have the subway. We don't have the Port Authority trains. We don't have the Long Island Railroad. Most of us don't live like that. Most of us don't hop in cars with other people and spend 45 minutes going one way and then at one part of the day and then another in an enclosed system where we're touching the same surfaces as dare I say, millions of other people have on a daily basis. Hundreds of thousands of other people as they go in and out of those trains, you know, in America's, you know, biggest city. So I believe that's a case for optimism. And if you look at those curves, and there's a chart that'll go up with this post, right? And it shows, I took kind of a snapshot of that slide. So it's cumulative, I can say it, cases per 100,000 in New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Washington, California. Washington, right, one of the earliest states impacted by that. Well, what explains that New York goes vertical and Washington has not yet? What explains that? What explains the fact that when you hear states being discussed relative to coronavirus, California isn't on that list? Now, you can say, well, the government shut travel to China down pretty early. The West Coast is a major destination for flights. You know, got it. Got all that. And that was shut down. Okay. Is that the only reason? So I think the West Coast benefits from two things. One, those flights, a lot of them that come from China to the West Coast, right, did not happen. And but again, the absence of mature mass transit system in those cities is a big deal. I mean, they have mass transit system, but most people don't take them. They're not well developed. They were put in after the cities were developed. And, you know, on the East Coast, you know, the New York City subway was like started in 1900. It's crazy. First of all, the foresight of the people who built it is unbelievable. And so anyhow, I just wanted to offer a little bit of a case for optimism, as well as talking about Mrs. Maisel. So, yeah, I believe that there's a reason, and you'll see these charts again, I would think, today. And so I would just say, if you begin to, and again, I talk about footnotes now all the time, right? If you look at the chart in this post that was put up yesterday in the, you know, and was discussed by Dr. Fauci, and her name is Dr. Bay. I think that's her name. I think I'm screwing that up. But anyway, if you look at that, even the Connecticut curve follows the same shape as the New Jersey curve and the New York City curve, or the New York curve. The New York curve, much higher relative to numbers, right? The New Jersey curve, right? Second in the country. Well, why New Jersey? Or why would New Jersey be so impacted? And then you see Connecticut, and all three curves follow the exact same arc, all three of them. Then you see California, and you see Washington, and they both have very, very much flatter, and their arcs aren't behaving the same way. So in the math that forms the arc, it's different. It's different. So interesting. So I think that makes a case for hope. And I would say statistically, I did this with Major League Baseball statistics, by the by. I don't think so. You have this big thing in baseball about analytics, right? And so when you go to the World Series, you know, this guy does this against this left-hand pitching, right-hand pitching. He does this against fastballs. He does this against breaking pitches. He does this against fastballs from right-hand hitters. He does this with fastballs against right-hand hitters with runners in scoring position. So, I mean, baseball has the, you know, the Vegematic, and they can slice it and dice it any way you want to look at statistics, right? Well, to me, what do the nation's statistics look like when you separate areas that have large metropolitan areas that have a mature mass transit system with ridership over X percentage of the population rides, right? And we'll define X by defining what ridership is in New York City, New Jersey, the Newark area, right? We'll take that and we'll say, okay, that's ridership there. Okay, so what will be the threshold, right, that gets you into that group of statistics, and what would be the threshold that keeps you out of that threshold, that group? And so you would have two groups. And I would submit to you that the groups with those incubators, those coronavirus incubators, and the subway still runs, right? It's still running. There's people getting on those things every day, and they continue to transmit it every day. They have not shut it down, right? New York City can't function if you shut it down. So anyhow, which is interesting, right? And it goes back to the way New York City was built vertically, right? New York City built vertically, which means you had to have some kind of mass transit system because otherwise people couldn't get there. Too many cars, not enough parking stalls, not enough parking garages. Can't do it. Got to have it. What made it be built vertical? Cheap steel. Andrew Carnegie. Right, a little bit of economic history for you. So anyway, I think that's interesting. And I think that if you look at the percentage of the country that does not have a mature mass transportation system, right? I think that that will give you that you will see data driven in those two major groups. In those two major groups, and I think what 80 to 90% of the country doesn't have a mature mass transportation system, which means we don't collide like that every day. And if states took reasonable measures to social distance, then those numbers ought to be vastly different than those states who do have large urban centers with mature mass transportation system. So a little bit of reason for hope. How about that? Now, I want to play for you the whole issue of I've got kind of interested in, you know, industrial capacity. And, you know, studying this is I'm sure very closely is the Industrial War College. I think that's what they call it. And so I'm sure that they're studying this very interestingly, or with, I should say it, with great interest. So anyway, how would they look at it? Okay. Well, how quickly can you convert industrial capacity to some other function? In this case, respirators. So I've gotten kind of interested in that because it's like big announcement, you know, GM, you know, going to make respirators. Tesla, going to make respirators. 3M, going to make respirators and everything else they can make, right? And then you have other organizations that are doing this kind of stuff. So anyway, I got kind of interested. Now, I want to play a little interview clip this morning that I saw. Ed Henry from Fox News interviewing a guy who's in charge of the trade organization for people that manufacture respirators here in the United States. So listen to this.
485. That's 1-800-333.
Oh, here's a commercial. I didn't have a chance to clip it. Normally I do.
With life-saving ventilators that we've heard so much about in short supply, the U.S. manufacturing industry is mobilizing to ramp up production of these machines to treat critically ill COVID-19 patients.
Now, one of the things we talked about is, yeah, this is not like I need a sprocket and a couple of pedals and a chain, okay? And that's not what this kind of manufacturing is. And so you hear people saying, well, why can't we make these things, right? What is the deal? So here's a footnote to that.
Scott Whitaker is the president and CEO of AdvaMed, a medical technology trade association directly involved with the government's response to the outbreak. He joins us now. Scott, we really appreciate you joining us.
Good to be with you, Ed.
Talk a little bit, first of all, about these machines, since you run this association. We're all learning a lot about them. How sophisticated are they? How complicated is it to manufacture one?
Well, it's a very sophisticated machine. There are about 1,700 individual component parts that go into it.
All right. Did you hear that? There's about 1,700 individual component parts. Okay. How many people do you think supply those individual component parts? A lot. Okay. Yeah.
Manufacturing a ventilator. And there are two types of those. Those that are invasive that you see in the ICU. And then there are those that are non-invasive that help people as they're going into or coming out of ICU. And we manufacture both of them. And in each case, it's a very challenging process to manufacture and scale to production level that we need right now.
Well, and we see our car companies, whether it be Ford, General Motors, stepping up as well. Talk about the effort, first of all, to manufacture, and then we'll get into distribution.
Yeah, on the manufacturing side, I'll give you a sense of what it was like before the crisis. We would do about 600 or 700 ventilators a week on the manufacturing side. We've begun to scale that up dramatically in the course of the last few weeks. We're doing about 3,000, maybe 4,000 a week now. And the goal is, just in the med tech industry alone, to get to 10 or 15,000 later this month. So we're scaling as fast as we can, working around the clock. We're taking shifts that were 8-hour shifts, turning them into 24/7 shifts. The employees of each of these companies are stepping up big time to meet that demand. And we hope by the end of this month, we'll scale to a level that is just tremendous. I will say also, Ed, the help that's coming from the GMs and the Fords and the other auto manufacturers has been great, and we welcome that.
Absolutely. And by the way, we're seeing live pictures right now of the Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence. You see him. He is in Virginia. He's going to be at a Walmart distribution center. He's going to be with the Agriculture Secretary, Sonny Perdue. Walmart is another company that has been in the middle of this to make sure the supply chains are still going, make sure that people all around the country are getting groceries and all the rest of it. So, Scott, as we watch that live picture of the Vice President, if he says anything, I might interrupt you and we might dip in to hear from him. But in the meantime, talk about this mobilization effort, because I assume you're working with the Vice President who's leading the task force, at least in general, whether you've spoken to him directly or not, because the next question beyond manufacture is how you distribute these ventilators to make sure the governors who need them are getting them.
Well, I'll tell you, Ed, we have been working with all levels of government, from the President of the United States, the Vice President, all the way through the health agency. Secretary Azar has been fantastic. The commissioner of FDA that helps us scale these folks, these products, to make sure that they're safe and effective in hospitals has been great. So across the board, the federal response from our perspective has been very, very good. And we're continuing that collaboration with FEMA now, because now the allocation portion is what's most challenging for us. We can manufacture to a high level and dramatically increase that scale. Where we need the most help is knowing where to ship these and how to get them there in a timely way for the hospitals, for the states, and the local providers to deal with this crisis.
Right. So between the task force, FEMA, and others, making sure they're distributed. Final question. I've just got 30 seconds, which is, when you're talking about getting to scale by the end of April, all of that, do you believe you're going to be able to meet the demand? That's what our viewers want to know.
I think the answer is yes. We'll do everything we can to meet demand. I think what we've seen inside of our industry and those outside of our industry is the willingness and desire to meet this challenge head on. And I'm certain we'll do it. I'm confident in this industry and proud of the work we're doing.
So there you have it. Not an easy machine to manufacture. So, you know, when you say you'll do it, you just did the easy part. And then, you know, then there's the negotiations you got to enter into. You got to keep with your board. Are we going to make money? Are we going to, because if we go sideways or even lose money, that's okay. We just got to have a plan. And how do we pay for that? And then how do we make sure that people understand that we played a role in this if we're going to lose money? The government's job is to guarantee that they don't lose money, right? Is that the wartime, you know, footing that, you know, the president has placed some of these companies on, you know, there are implications to that, and the government has a role in that. In that, if a company shuts down its production lines, if it modifies the way it lives, you know, and it does it at its own expense, will the federal government mitigate, you know, those losses? And you know, the answer is yes. Federal government should, if they invoke this, they have to indemnify the they have to ensure that these companies that participate, you know, don't. Because there's an opportunity cost. If I'm making Teslas and I'm going to make, you know, respirators, the profit margin on Tesla probably a little bit different than the profit margin on a respirator. Well, maybe not. Now that the whole world's competing for respirators, maybe there's enough profit margin in that. But I don't think so. So, I mean, there's a cost that comes with it. So, anyway, I think interesting issues. And I haven't heard enough footnotes. See, I didn't used to like, there's a guy on TV named Tucker Carlson. And I didn't used to like him. I don't want to say that I like him now. But last night he did a segment on the origins of the coronavirus, and he talked about what Chinese researchers found, okay, and the fact that he talked about the World Health Organization being kind of a lapdog for the Chinese, you know, and that the United States ought to reconsider the way it funds its funding to the World Health Organization. And so I wanted to share some of this report with you because I thought it was pretty good. And it relies on Chinese research and what they concluded and what they put up on the internet, which I thought was pretty novel. Now, let me see if I can get this to work.
Scientists from the South China University of Technology uploaded a paper on the origins of coronavirus. Where did it come from? Well, this offers some clue. At the time, the official death toll in China from the coronavirus was 564. The paper made a number of notable observations and claims that are worth knowing about, and that's why we're telling you.
Okay, now, so this is a paper from Chinese researchers at a Chinese university. Okay. And anyway, I haven't seen this covered by anybody else, so I thought it was interesting.
We want to be clear that we're not endorsing any of these conclusions. We haven't independently confirmed them. We can't. But you should keep in mind as you hear this that these findings come from Chinese scientists who work for a university that is controlled by the Chinese government. So whatever else they are, the views you're about to hear are probably not racist anti-Chinese propaganda. Here's what the paper says. First, the scientists confirm what scientists around the world have said they believe. The virus most likely came from an animal known as the intermediate horseshoe bat. Here's the striking thing. There are no known colonies of this bat within 900 kilometers of Wuhan, nor is there any evidence that they were sold in the Wuhan wet market, despite many claims in the American media to the contrary, including on this show, by the way. Last night, we did a segment on wet markets, the one in Wuhan included, and suggested that this bat was sold there. But let's be clear. The only actual analysis of that question that we're aware of is in this paper. These scientists interviewed almost 60 people, 59 of them, who frequented the Wuhan wet market. They confirmed there were no horseshoe bats for sale there, period. So that raises the question, where did the virus-carrying bats come from? And the paper says this, quote, "We screened the area around the market and identified two laboratories conducting research on bat coronavirus. Within a few hundred yards of the wet market was something called the Wuhan Center for Disease Control and Prevention. According to public reports, the center used intermediate horseshoe bats for research. Then about 7 miles away was another facility. This one was called the Wuhan Institute of Virology. The Virology Institute also conducted research on intermediate horseshoe bats, the ones that were not sold at the wet market."
Now, remember, this is the report from the Chinese university. This is not Tucker Carlson going off in his own version of reality.
South China University scientists concluded that the coronavirus pandemic, the one that people are dying from here, likely came from one of these two government labs in Wuhan. They noticed that a scientist at the Wuhan Center for Disease Control and Prevention had been exposed to the blood and urine of horseshoe bats. They also suggested that infected tissue samples from research animals may have wound up in the Wuhan wet market. And they ended the paper this way, quote, "The killer coronavirus probably originated from a laboratory in Wuhan. Safety levels may need to be reinforced in high-risk biohazardous laboratories. Regulations may be taken to relocate these laboratories far away from city centers and other densely populated places." End quote. How's that for interesting? Now, this paper has been online for nearly 2 months, and so far it has been virtually ignored in this country. Almost nobody in American journalism has dared to write about it. The few who have were immediately attacked as dangerous conspiracy theorists. Instead of assessing what seemed like the rational conclusions presented in the Chinese paper, there was a spate of American news stories and academic research designed to show that the coronavirus absolutely could not have been engineered in a Chinese lab. They sounded supremely confident of that. But do they really know it? And the answer is no, they don't. As a factual matter, it is impossible for Western scientists to settle the question either way. So instead of doing that or admitting that, they amped up the rhetoric, hoping that you wouldn't notice the difference. A post on the National Institutes of Health website, written by NIH Director Francis Collins himself, dismisses any such speculation as, quote, outrageous. Keep in mind, NIH is supposed to be keeping you safe from diseases like this one, not running political interference for hostile foreign governments. This is how they're spending their time as Americans die in the middle of a global pandemic. And still, no one addressed the substance of the claims. The South China University paper concludes that the virus probably escaped accidentally from a lab in Wuhan. It said not one word about bioweapons. Yet the NIH and USA Today and countless other outlets have devoted thousands of words to scolding you for thinking the virus may have been a form of biological warfare. Notice that's a totally different claim than the one made in the paper. And that's not accidental. One of the surest signs that people are lying to you is when they answer questions you didn't ask. And that's exactly what the professional class is doing with this story. And they're doing it on many fronts. They're lying to you. They're claiming to know things they don't know. They're dismissing the obvious as impossible. They're blaming you for their failures. And the media are helping them do it. The stakes are too high to let them continue this way. So no matter what, stay skeptical as you assess the world. Remain rational. Gather your own evidence and come to your own conclusions. You shouldn't have to do that. You ought to be able to trust the people in charge. But you can't. So at this point, you have no choice.
Yeah, I don't normally like that guy very much. But I'll tell you what, I sure like the shit out of that. Yeah. You know, finally something based on fact and science and something that comes from China. But again, probably not going to see that in mainstream American media because it doesn't fit the narrative of, like the headline I saw the other day, 170 respirators that Trump sent to California aren't fully functional. Actually, it was don't work. And then when you read the story, you find that it's a FEMA shipment and they op-checked them. And out of, I don't know, however many hundred they got, a certain percentage had something that didn't work that was fixable. But that's not the headline, right? That's not what sells. Sex sells. So anyway, so I thought I would present, you know, first of all, Mrs. Maisel. She's funny. But again, it's not stupid person humor. Okay, and it's one of the things I like about people that listen to this show. Like, if you're dumb, you tend not to like this show. Because this show, although it can be stupid at times, which is one of the things I love about it, it is, you know, it's fairly, you know, intellectual. So Colleen and I watched it last night. And, right, the family's Jewish. And the father brings up an old boyfriend. And the daughter says, why would you bring him up? And the father says something like this, right? I don't know. God, he reminded me of the pole vaulter in, oh my God, I just screwed up the punchline. And he says, oh my God, I don't know. You know, he reminded me of the pole vaulter in The Triumph of Will. Now, for you to understand how funny that is, you know, said by a German, you have to understand what Triumph of Will was, right? It was Hitler's propaganda movie made by a woman named Leni Riefen. I can't remember his last name. Reinfeld, something like that. It's this tribute to what it is to be Aryan. Blonde hair, blue eyes, like gods and goddesses in the Olympics. And so it's hilarious, though. I started laughing and stopped the program. Colleen looks at me like, what? I'm like, how can I watch this with you? And she started laughing. I said, you're not smart enough. Get out of here right now. She said, no, explain it to me. I said, no. So I explained it to her. But so if you like that kind of humor, Mrs. Maisel, hope, right? I think statistically, when you begin to stratify the data, right? Like the data that we get, like the way we've sliced and diced and racked and stacked data for Major League Baseball, you will come to the conclusion. I believe that, you know, that you'll see graphically that social distancing is working for places that don't have mature mass transportation systems and acted fairly early in this whole thing. Okay. Florida, another case in point. Yeah, everybody's pissed about the video that came out of spring break. And there are cases have edged up as people from New York City have come down to Florida. Okay. But they don't have a mature mass transportation system. So they don't have a way of transmitting it throughout the region, throughout the city in a big way. And so Miami will not follow the same curve as the New York City area. And so anyway, so memo to Governor Cuomo, dial your shit down. The whole rest of the country will not go down, in my opinion, the path that New York City and New Jersey and Connecticut are going down. And you owe that to a couple things, slow to shut things down and the way your city is constructed. If you shut down the subway, what happens? What happens? You shut down the Port Authority, you know, train system. You shut down the Long Island Railroad. What happened? And that has to be a consideration, because when you take New York City, New Jersey statistics out of the American statistics, they plunge. Okay. United States Marine Corps band makes it official. I got other stuff I got to talk about too. All right. So Grant Newsham's going to join us today. So I emailed him. I said, hey, I screwed up. He said, what this time? I said, don't say it like that. So we'll talk to Grant about all this stuff. All right. We'll talk to Grant about all this stuff. So good morning to you on a Wednesday, hump day, April 1st. Don't be a dope. Okay. Don't fall for any stupid April 1st. Stupid April 1st stuff. Now, I got an email earlier. I've kind of been in a funk. I haven't been listening. Let me just tell you symptoms of going into a funk. One of them is not listening to All Marine Radio. Okay? Because All Marine Radio is funny. It's practical. It's down to earth. I'm funny. I'm practical. I'm down to earth. That's why the show's like it is. Okay? So fucking listen. Make sure you put it on your schedule. Don't miss. Right? It's a way to stay connected. It's a way to stay grounded. It's a way to be encouraged and optimistic. All right? So, with that said, quit fucking it up. Good morning to you. The United States Marine Corps Band makes this official. This dedicated to everybody's effort to social distance, okay? Here's the objective. You're going to come out. If you want to lose weight, you got a perfect Groundhog Day event to structure your life and lose that weight, okay? All you got to do is add a second physical fitness event in and watch what happens, okay? So, you know, I kind of do my stretching. I do yoga. I go for a walk at noon. Okay. Now that you have a little bit of extra time in the evening, go for another walk. Go for a second walk. Okay? Get on the bike a second time. Even if it's only for 15 minutes, add a second physical fitness. All right? Start listening to or reading books. I'm crushing audiobooks now. Just for the record. I am absolutely killing them. Okay? So at the end of this, I'm going to be smarter. I'm going to be poorer. Which fucking pisses me off, but that's life, okay? I'm fighting it, but, I mean, talk about having a shit business for the coronavirus, just as it was, like, exploding, right? Yeah, there's no travel, and we can't get together in groups, huh? You know, fucking dooms. Post-traumatic winning. Shit. All right. So, but I'll conquer that. Okay. So at the far end of this, you want to say, hey, man, I leverage that shit. And you want to teach your kids how to do it, too. And the people around you. Right? Be that beacon of hope. Now, for me, for my friends, we've lived through this shit before. Places like Iraq, Afghanistan, aboard ship. This is what it's like. Fucking Groundhog Day. You get up. Imagine this. Iraq, Afghanistan. You get up. You go to work. You help kill people. You help save people. Right? If you can get up early enough, right? You can eat. You can go work out or go work out and then go eat. And then you can write a letter, and then you fall the fuck asleep. And then you do it again. Hey, Mac, how many days a week would you do that? 7 days a week? Well, when do you get an off day? When you come home? What? Exactly. Well, what about job burnout? Well, what a fucking about it? It's not allowed, okay? Job burnout is not allowed. People depend on you. So you got to show up. You have to have your head in the fucking game, right? And in order to keep your sanity, you got to PT, right? You got to eat right, right? You got to keep your brain stimulated, and you got to sleep, okay? So for us, we know how to do this shit. We know how to live like shit. And we want to offer our advice to the rest of you. So you got to eat right. You got to sleep, even if it means you got to take a nap. Okay, if you can do that, and you got a PT. So, everybody got it? Okay, this is dedicated to all you people out there that are doing this.
Betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
Once you're out of the core, you know, it's your responsibility to live your life in a way that would honor those that were with you and died. I mean, don't waste your life. Goodness, do something meaningful and don't be going out there saying, look, oh, woe is me. I'm a poor veteran, or I'm a disabled veteran. Well, yeah, I am a disabled veteran. But, you know, we can't have that kind of attitude. We've got to show people that, hey, we care about our country. We care about what happens to everyone. Marine Corps changed me. It made me a better man, but I don't know a Marine that wouldn't tell you the same thing, Mike.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
Oh, I got to tell you something else, too. You heard Jack Riley's voice. If you missed the interview with him yesterday, talking about going to be a part of Operation Buffalo, unintended, but they were the hella-born quick reaction force that flew from Dong Ha to Kantian when 1st Battalion 9th Marines tied into a whole lot of North Vietnamese soldiers in the DMZ. And so anyway, if you miss that, you got to listen to it. And then as I was perusing stuff yesterday, I see a book, and I run down the author of it, which took me a while. He finally called me. His name's James Cohn, and he was a tanker, a tank platoon commander at Kantian. And so you're going to hear from him. He's written two books, and we'll talk about both of them. One is kind of an overview of those battles, and then the second one was his personal story, and to include coming home and his struggle with PTSD. So had an awesome conversation with him yesterday. So you're going to meet him. Then after that, you're going to hear from guys, at least you'll hear from somebody from Bravo Company 19, and they were the point element that got hammered. And then you'll hear from guys in Alpha Company 19. They were to the west of Bravo Company, and you'll hear from them. And then you'll hear a second piece from James Cohn, and which is, you know, the QRFs and the tanks rolling that and all that kind of stuff. So, Kantian, I'm excited about that. Anyway, time to look at the news. I'm sorry, time to look at the weather. Currently in Quantico, it is cloudy and 49. Down the coast of Camp Lejeune, it is cloudy and 49. 29 Palms, sunny and 63. Pendleton, partly sunny and 55. Camp Smith in Hawaii, dark cloudy, 65. Okinawa, the exact same thing for the second day in a row. In the Helmand province of Afghanistan, early in the evening, 61. Ramadi, sun just setting, 78 degrees right now under clear skies. In Costa Mesa, Newport Beach area, it is 57 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. Looking for a high of 69 today, 68 tomorrow under partly sunny skies. And on Friday, sunny and 68. That's a look at your weather. We come back. I got some comments to make about another article written about General Berger's plan. So more of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home fort, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You know, I talk about how the news is bullshit, how your nightly news, wherever you watch it, is a conglomeration of things designed to get you to watch, to get you to click, that drives advertising revenue, that drives corporate profits. Okay? That's for-profit news. That's how it works. It is not a representation of the country, right? What do you see now across this country? In Seattle, they said, hey, we need people to help us make our own gowns and masks and things like that. And what happened? Overwhelming response, right? The Army says we need retired, right, medical people. We need people that have gotten out, right, in the last couple years. We need them to come back. And what happens? They get 9,000 responses, right? There's a thing called Operation Barbecue Relief, which is serving meals to medical workers and first responders. People that barbecue, right? And you're seeing this all over the country. I saw a story earlier today that somebody put out, you know, a call for masks, people that have them in boxes at home, you know, and they set up in a parking lot. I don't even know what city it was in. And it could have been Los Angeles because they said theater people, movie set people all had these because of the different things they'll paint, all the stuff they do. They have respirators in terms of masks. And they brought these things in carloads. That's our country, man. That's our country. All the people that volunteer to drive food around, that's the country you live in. Not this other shit show that everybody wants you to believe in. All right? So, anyway, I say that. I want to talk about General Berger's plan here. And I want to talk about Michael Gordon's article from last week. And I want to point out things that weren't in that article that I think are really important. And one of them, Michael Gordon. Michael Gordon is one of the most well-connected writers that writes on the defense industry, okay? And that's why he was given the story, because his credibility. Whoever called him and said, "Hey, Mike, we want you to do a story," what they were trying to do was using Michael Gordon's byline and the credibility that comes with that, they were trying to get him to write something favorable about what the Commandant was doing. Okay. And so, but Gordon's nobody's stooge. Okay. So, the headline of the article is Marines plan to retool to meet China threat. Okay. Most sweeping transformation in decades will shift focus from fighting insurgents in the Middle East to preparing for conflict in the Western Pacific. Now, I think the sub-headline's wrong. The most sweeping transformation in decades will focus solely on fighting in the Western Pacific at the expense of every other mission across the range of military operations. Now, that's probably too wordy for the Wall Street Journal and probably too technical. But that is probably something more appropriate, right? Now, right, so what the Commandant is doing, right, no matter who you talk to, they will tell you this. China, the greatest threat, least likely nation that will fight. Okay, so how in should you be in the most dangerous, least likely? Now you look at military history, right? Our own military history with the Soviet Union. Okay, we coexisted with the Soviet Union for 60 years. So most likely, least dangerous, and the Marine Corps all in on one fight. Now people say, "Oh, Mac, we're not all in on one fight." Bullshit. The whole Marine Corps is being redesigned for this. Now I'll tell you some other questions that people have asked me. Email, "Hey, Mac, even if the Navy built all these ships that you could put 100 Marines on, how many ships is that?" Good question. We've got 34, something like that. We need 38 right now. Most of them don't get to sea very easily because of the state of readiness, because amphibious operations aren't a high, item on the Navy's budget. So anyway, so that's a good question. So if it's 100, how about if they built us 100 ships? That would get, add the zeros, right? That would get us 10,000 Marines at sea in the area of operation. Well, how many Marines do you have in 1MEF and 3MEF? You have a third, you have most of the Marine Corps in those 2 MEFs. So even if we do it, you can't get everybody to the fight like that. So where's everybody else going? What's everybody else going to do? Everybody else is going to wait? And so the article leaves out, and let me tell you for me what's most apparent about Michael Gordon's article is what's not in there. Okay. What's not in there? Okay. Now, if you scroll through the article and you start looking for quotes, who's quoted? Scroll through it. You see any retired Marine generals quoted in there? So Michael Gordon, right? You only see one retired Marine Corps general that's quoted in there, and that's General Zinni. So what does it say when a guy as connected as Michael Gordon can't find, right, another retired Marine general officer to say anything good about this? Right? All he's got is think tank guys. Now, you've already heard about the, you know, Mark Kansian said, the predictive accuracy of think tank people in not just the United States, but all across the world. They're wrong. They're wrong. They're wrong. They're wrong. They're wrong. They're wrong. And so that's why Kansian makes the case for hedging. But that's not what I want to talk about. What I want to talk about is Gordon couldn't find anybody else, right? Did not quote anybody in the article that's supportive of what General Berger's doing. And the only person he does quote, now imagine General Zinni's position. Now, I haven't spoken to General Zinni, but I'd love to. Okay. And, but general officers are pretty particular about picking fights in public. They don't make each other look bad. And I think there's an unwritten rule that once you retire, you sure as hell don't do that. Okay? Now, not everybody follows it, but most people do. So here's the only quote, right? So what's not in the article is any supportive quote by any retired general officer. Not one. And it's not like Michael Gordon doesn't know him. So here's a quote, right? Now, here's a paragraph before General Zinni's quote. Some retired Marines, plural. Now, so what does that mean? He talked to retired Marine general officers who he knows, who trust him. But you know what they told him? This is off the record. You cannot use my name. Right? That's what that means. Some retired Marines caution that too heavy a focus on China may make the Corps less flexible in dealing with conflicts that might erupt in the Middle East and other distant regions, which they consider to be more likely. Okay? And what happens to the Marine Corps when it starts missing fights? Yeah, well, we don't do windows anymore. Well, I can tell you what the argument's always been. When you start missing fights, that whole sentence, right? The nation needs the Army. The nation needs the Navy. The nation needs the Air Force. The nation doesn't need the Marine Corps. When you make yourself less than capable across the range of military operations, you marginalize yourself. And trust me, Congress can revisit that law that says there needs to be a Marine Corps with three infantry divisions and three air wings. They can revisit that law. So think about that as you frame this discussion, right? Not one general officer is quoted in here. And then how Gordon phrases it. Some retired Marines caution. So let me tell you what that means. That means he talked to multiple people who would not be quoted for the article, who told him the same thing. Okay? Who told him the same thing. Less flexible. So what is the historic value of the Marine Corps? Right? We are the most bang for the buck. When the Marine Corps sells itself, they put up this is how many people we're going to put in there. This is how many, right? This is how much it's going to cost you. This is how it breaks down cost per combatant. And this is us compared to the Army. This is us compared to the Air Force. This is what you get in your Marine Corps. Boom. So most boom for the buck. We'll fight tonight. Right? And we bring a sledgehammer when we come. And we can come to a mechanized fight. We can come to a low-intensity conflict fight. And we bring a sledgehammer every time we come. That's your Marine Corps. That's the historical value to the Marine Corps. Well, not in the future it won't be. Okay, so this is General Zinni's quote. Quote, now imagine the situation Zinni's in, okay? And I know this because I talked to not him, but on other issues where I've solicited comment, right, I know what I hear in response. So what Tony Zinni, in my opinion, the quintessential Marine in my lifetime, what he has to navigate is talking to Michael Gordon, who I assume he knows and has known for a long time. Because Gordon, let me tell you, I first saw Michael Gordon stories when I was in Iraq. He was one of the few people who knew what the fuck he was talking about. And I didn't know Michael Gordon from shit. But I, when I read his articles, he was one of the few people that knew what he was talking about. And so I'd read his articles all the time. And they've always been good. And I've said that for years on this program. You want to read credible, right, stuff about the DOD, about America at war, find Michael Gordon and read what Michael Gordon writes. Okay, so here's what Zinni has to do. If he wants to allow Michael Gordon to quote him, then he's got to be very careful what he says, right? Tony Zinni, like all these general officers, doesn't want to pick with a fight with Commandant of the Marine Corps, in public, no less. Right? So here's the quote. Quote, "I think it's a mistake to organize yourself in a way to go after a specific region. Something could happen tomorrow with the Iranians. The answer is be ready, expeditionary, and balanced." Now, not very critical. Didn't take issue with General Berger's course of action. Be ready, be expeditionary, be balanced. That is the history of the Marine Corps. So I just wanted to point that out. Now, there's another article written by a guy named Dan Gurr. I think that's how you say it. It might be Gore, G-O-U-R, or Gory. And it appears in Real Clear Defense. The headline is, "Will Commandant Berger's new Marine Corps be a high-tech forlorn hope?" Forlorn hope, right? And I think you have to understand the term forlorn hope in military history. I've seen it most associate in American military history associated with the Battle of Gettysburg. So if you type in forlorn hope, I think what you find is the 16th Maine at Gettysburg. Forlorn hope, right? I'm sorry, the 1st Maine Heavy Artillery. So it's pregnant with military meaning if you're, you know, into military history. Anyway, so I'll put the link in here, you know, and I'll read the last paragraph of what he writes. "Most capabilities Force Design 2030 wants by that date have not yet been developed. It is difficult to believe that the Marine Corps can acquire a range of new weapon systems with the combination of requirements, long-range precision, mobility, and low cost necessary to implement General Berger's vision. For example, at the same time it was releasing the new force design paper, the Marine Corps sent out a request for information to industry for a system to be mounted on a joint light tactical vehicle to defeat fixed and rotary wing manned and unmanned aerial threats. Instead of a viable Marine Corps for a future great power conflict, Force Design 2030 may be a recipe for the creation of a forlorn hope. For the non-military historian, these were small formations of select or volunteers assigned particularly hazardous missions. Because their chance of survival was so slim, they were called forlorn hope. In the earliest Dutch version of the term, lost troops, operating in China's backyard, the new Marine Corps could be facing a bleak future." Dan Gurry is a vice president of public policy research think tank, Lexington Institute. We'll see if we can get Dan on. Because, again, you've heard Kansian, you've heard Hamas. You know, this is an important discussion. So, we're going to take a break. More Volmering Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.